Meili Chai.
Thank you. It's an honor to read here in the Poetry Center at San Francisco State. Thank you so much, Steve, and it's an honor to be reading with Jens Kim. I'm going to just read an excerpt from one of the stories in Useful Phrases for Immigrants, but I'll tell you a little bit of background. I put this collection together in 2016 during the presidential primary. This was my act of resistance. I did not think that a certain real estate developer from New York was going to get the nomination, much less the presidency, but I was very worried about his rhetoric, his anti-immigrant rhetoric, his anti-woman rhetoric, just the really ugly things he was saying. I thought it had reached a new level of just blunt hatred. And I thought, well, there's no way he can win, you know, but he, by just voicing this and normalizing it on television and on the campaign trail, that there was no closing this Pandora's box and that we were going to have to live with the reverberations of this for a while. So I thought about like all the stories I was working on, stories that I had published, stories that I was still working on, and I thought I'd put them together into a collection to kind of push back against these dehumanizing ways of describing large swaths of humanity. And you know, immigrants who are part of America, and migrants who just cross borders because that's what human beings do and have done throughout human history. And in particular, China. I remember him saying, China is raping the US. And I thought, that is a really disgusting thing to say. And a normal politician doesn't talk about another country, much less a trade partner, in such hideous language. We're not in a war. Even if we were in a war, it's a disgusting thing to say. So I decided to draw upon stories of Chinese migrants and immigrants. And so in the collection, I have stories set in China, and I've got migrants from the countryside into cities. As you may know, Chinese migrants in mega factories are the people who make all of our stuff, our clothes, our iPhones, our computers, our toys. And they don't have a lot of rights in Chinese cities. They leave the countryside, and they're not allowed to bring their families with them. They're not allowed to bring their children with them when they live in the city in these mega factories. They have to go home once a year sometimes is all they're allowed, sometimes once every few years if they're in a busy cycle of manufacturing. And so they've left behind children who are being raised by grandparents. So I've got a story about a left behind child and the grandfather who's raising him. I also have stories of Chinese entrepreneurs, people who have, you know, saved and worked really hard all of their lives and decide to come to America for their own American dream. Only in this case of the story in the book, to hit the 2008 financial crisis and to see their dream hit that brick wall. I thought it was ridiculous that on the campaign trail, all of these right-wing politicians were pretending that globalization doesn't affect other people in other countries. Like, only Americans are affected by globalization? That's insane. Think of the word. Of course, Chinese people and Chinese people in diaspora feel economic anxiety and cultural dislocation because of all of these changes that are happening around the world. So I also have Chinese families who've come as refugees after World War II, and I have Chinese families who've been here for multiple generations. And the goal is to present a human face to the very ugly rhetoric of dehumanization. And little did I know, 2 years later, that things would be so much worse, that we would be putting children in cages on the US-Mexico border, that we would be having white supremacists feel so empowered that they can go into a synagogue and shoot to death Jewish people in their own temple, that we would have this constant, ugly dehumanization of so many groups that make America a wonderful country. So I'm going to read just an excerpt from one of the short stories called Ghost Festivals. And it's set in maybe 2014, but it goes back to the 1970s, and it's kind of highlighting the struggles and the intersectionality of immigrant groups in the United States and how there's always this push and pull between preserving culture and deciding what culture means and preserving family and accepting change. And then who do you respect in your new culture? Who gets to set that sense of belonging? So ghost festivals. Uncle Lincoln called to ask me if I'd heard the news. It was all over the internet. The Pope has come out in favor of gay marriage. He said it in a press conference in Rome. It's amazing, Lu Ying, he said. I never thought I'd live to see this day. I didn't have the heart to tell him it was a hoax. The same as the reports that Pope Francis had said hell was a literary device. My friends had been liking it all day on Facebook until someone thought to check Snopes. But on the other hand, who knew? Maybe this Pope really did think these things, and it was only the public airing that was false. I thought of your mother today, Uncle Lincoln said. Because of the Pope? No, because it's your parents' anniversary. Oh, shit, I thought. I'd completely forgotten. Did you call my dad? I left a message. He didn't answer. He'll be happy you remembered, I said. I glanced at the clock on the wall. Still time before it was midnight in New Jersey. I could call right after Lincoln hung up. Of course, he said, his voice offended. I never forget. I know, I'm sorry, I said. I always light a candle for your mother on my shrine. I've got my own ancestor altar set up with pictures of Ba and Ma and, of course, your mother. Did you put it up for Qingming, I said? No, Qingming is next month, Uncle Lincoln explained patiently. I keep the candle up year-round. I couldn't keep track of when Chinese New Year fell, much less the festivals for the dead. It wasn't just that the lunar calendar threw me, but the fact that Chinese traditionally celebrated the dead more than the living. Birthdays didn't count. Everyone used to add a year on the first day of Spring Festival, aka Chinese New Year. But memorial days were essential. There was the 49th day after death when the gates of the underworld opened and the newly departed could finally go to the other side. The official ghost day when we were supposed to burn incense money and set out plates of fruit for hungry ghosts wandering in between reincarnations. Anniversaries of deaths of grandparents and ancestors I'd never met. Qingming for sweeping the tombs or changing the flowers in front of my paternal grandparents' mausoleum. When I was younger, I'd never understood why it was important to memorialize death days more than birthdays. But what really made me marvel was thinking that Uncle Lincoln still carried a candle for my mother. She'd dated him first before she met my father. Not that it'd ever been serious, but I think she represented something glamorous to Lincoln, some fantasy version of his life, the path not taken, all that. They used to like to dress up and go to parties in Manhattan, Broadway plays, recitals by famous musicians. I must have known, Mom would later say of their time together. He had a roommate, and the roommate always acted so jealous whenever I came over, but we never talked about such things in those days. I don't know if he ever knew about her taking part in the letter campaign to get soap taken off the air because Billy Crystal played a gay man trying to win custody of his child. It was 1977, before Lincoln came out, and the church had condemned the show. My mother, dutiful Catholic, wrote her letters without ever watching an episode. I saw them in the typewriter that summer. I watched an episode secretly after I eavesdropped on her conversation with Sister Kevin. I checked the TV guide, planned a distraction with the dogs, and turned to the channel when Mom was busy. All I remember was how boring it was, all those grown-ups talking, talking, talking. The Hardy Boys' Nancy Drew mysteries had started the same year. It was all I could talk about. I collected the cover profiles of Pamela Sue Martin from People and Tiger Beat. I had the lunchbox, the T-shirts, the matching notebooks and folders. Mom was worried and had complained to Sister Kevin about me. I'm afraid Lu Ying loves that TV show more than God. Sister Kevin, bless her, had reassured Mom that it was just a phase. Every girl loves Nancy Drew, she said. I loved Sister then, too. I remember that summer well. I was going to start junior high. I was going to turn 12. My father was busy teaching summer school and worrying about money. My mother was overseeing the construction on our house and worrying about money. There were strange men coming in and out, fixing the carpets, tearing out a wall, adding a shower to the half bath off the kitchen. Our mother hated our house, our busy street, and was convinced if she could only update the floor plan, we'd be able to sell and move to a better neighborhood, meaning one she preferred, on a quieter street in another town. I buried myself in my books, dreading the move and the loss of my friends. One Sunday, we took a rare break from the routine of Lewis and me being locked out of the house while our parents cleaned up after the workmen and argued. We were going to Manhattan to have brunch at my grandparents' favorite Chinese restaurant, Chun Sha Fu, on West 69th, to celebrate something. Good news, my grandfather had told my father over the phone. He'd tell us when we got there. All right, so then there's a section, I'm going to jump ahead, and they go to visit the grandparents, and there's been some horrible argument. And the grandfather is missing, and the grandmother won't come out, and they go and they wait in the restaurant for hours and hours and hours. And what they find out is that the grandfather has had a kind of like a scare of a heart attack because Uncle Lincoln has announced to them that he's getting married. He's engaged to his secretary, who is pregnant with another man's child. The next month, everything in the family changed. We didn't meet for Sunday brunch at all. There was too much fighting. Uncle Harry and Aunt Marcy announced they were boycotting the wedding. Aunt Marcy had just gotten a gig as the organist at St. Anne's. She wasn't even Catholic. At best, she was a lukewarm Lutheran. But she said, how would it look? And Uncle Harry wasn't talking to us at all. Mom said he'd been in denial. It wasn't her fault that she'd spilled Uncle Lincoln's secret. No one told Ye or Nainai why everyone was fighting. So Nainai assumed the family was taking sides for and against Maricelis. She wrote long letters to my father with pictures of various Chinese girls that she solicited from friends, from other old ladies at her senior center, her old missionary acquaintances, who knows where else. Ugh, what a mess, Dad said when he said anything at all. Mostly he buried himself in his schoolwork, refusing to answer the phone or come to dinner on time. He had taken over the family room for his study, his piles of notes and typed pages spreading across the two folding tables and the end table. So Lewis and I weren't allowed there anymore either, which meant there was no more TV for us that summer. We were confined to the backyard or our own rooms until the house was finished, which seemed an ever dicier proposition. I couldn't even have tuned in to soap if I'd wanted to. I had no idea where to turn for more information, for guidance. I didn't feel like this situation was something I could talk to my friends about. I was left to stew in my own ignorance, my Nancy Drew mysteries providing no clues whatsoever. To think, Mom said, I could have married him someday if I'd only known. She said this several times a week, at dinner or in the car while we were driving to the grocery store, and once before breakfast during the middle of the Today Show. I had the TV on in the kitchen because Jean Shalit was going to talk to Pamela Sue Martin, and I refused to leave for school until I saw the interview. I'd become obsessed with Ms. Martin, her dark red hair, her sleepy eyes, the voice like a girl who'd just gotten up no matter what time of day she was speaking. I didn't have words yet for the way I felt about her. That too was a mystery. Dad had already left for work and it was just the three of us around the table. Mom said, it's not that I don't love your father, but I never realized I had a chance with Lincoln. She sighed in a long, dramatic way. But then you wouldn't have us, Lewis said. Oh, I'd have children like you, Mom said quickly. And then she laughed, ha, 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 dramatic and deliberate. I'm just kidding. I love you very much. She pulled Lewis close to her and kissed him on the top of his head. That September, school started and our house was still in disrepair. I hoped that meant we might not really move and I might be able to stay with my friends. Junior high began just like any year in elementary school for me, except Nancy Drew Mysteries was canceled on TV, and all my friends started reading Trixie Belden. Dad took over the ping pong table for his books as the construction spread to the basement, and that meant no more ping pong for Lewis and me. My skills got rusty, and Gertrude Harder was able to beat me in gym class 11-9, 13-11, 11-7. Then, at the last minute, just before Christmas, Lincoln announced the engagement was called off. Maricelis's old boyfriend came back, and at first Mom thought that meant Maricelis would marry him. But instead, Maricelis told Lincoln she found marriage to be a bourgeois establishment affectation to oppress women, and she had decided to stay single. Uncle Lincoln moved to the West Coast after that, to California. I wish we could all go with him, Mom said. The family had started getting together again, even if there was a Lincoln-shaped hole in our universe. Nai Nai liked to bring his letters to read bits out loud, as though he were seated at the table still, so his brothers could hear how he was doing. He'd found a couple of teaching jobs at a community college, nothing tenure track yet, and one Sunday, Nai Nai announced proudly that he was running a Saturday enrichment program for at-risk youth. Uncle Harry said, "Lincoln is a pervert. They should keep him away from the children." He said this loudly enough for us to hear at the kids' table to the side. None of the other adults said anything after that. Silence fell over the table and the congealing plates of brown sauce long beans and half-eaten mugu gai pan. Soon it was time to leave, to drop Nai Nai and Yeye back at their apartment. Nobody was hungry enough to order a final soup. Dad said that Uncle Harry had always been jealous because Lincoln was the youngest. After Lincoln was born, he felt he never got any attention. Mom cried all the way home, through the grim traffic in the Lincoln Tunnel. I watched the condensation dripping down the stained tile walls, and Lewis wondered aloud what kept the water of the Hudson from seeping inside and drowning us all. I didn't say anything, but I felt the problem was that no one in the family had learned to stand up to Uncle Harry's bullying. He was considered the clever one, the successful businessman, and he had the most money, which intimidated my grandparents into thinking he was something they should be proud of. After that, we didn't get together so much. And there is more, but that is the excerpt that I will read. Thank you.